Good morning, if it is still morning. I'm Mike Duff, I'm the host, but the people you really want to hear about are right next to me. The topic is decision-making when instability is the only constant. And Nick Steen and Catalina Flores of Euromotor International are here to provide some ideas about how to proceed through rocky times. Euromotor International is at Innovation Theater to provide an overview, of the significant pressures the marketplace faced in 2022 and the responses to conditions that made a difference. Then the question becomes how related consumer behaviors have changed over the past couple of years and how that is translating into home furnishings and housewares industries. Nick works with Euromonitor's research processes, services, and technology as applied to the home and garden industry. Catalina is Euromonitor senior analyst, home and technology, focused on the United States and Canada. Please welcome Nick and Catalina.
Thank you, Mike, for that introduction. So my name is Nick. I'm Global Head of Home and Garden for Euromonitor. That means that my scope runs over home improvement, as well as gardening and the housewares and furniture industries. I've also got connections into the consumer appliances space, the cleaning space. So when I'm looking at the picture for the global parameters, I'm seeing the wider scope, smart home, and all of the various technologies that are feeding into this. So we're here talking today about decision making, and one of the factors that's most clear inside of this is so many of the foundation elements for looking ahead are under threat. They're inside of pressures on levels and from directions that we've just never experienced to this scale before. So how do you actually see forward under such circumstances? And it's even to the most basic of things. So we're researchers, we're speakers, we're authors. It's even down to the fact that words are no longer having the same sort of meaning that they used to. Think about the word crisis. If we put it in context of 2019 and before, what actually now constitutes a crisis? Because what we used to think of a crisis is now just Monday morning, and it's every Monday morning. And we're getting to the stage where if it's not double digits, we're not going to get excited about it. So what is a crisis now? We've overused that word to the point where it literally has next to zero meaning. So it's things like this that allow us to start articulating and thinking, okay, well, what is solid and what is real? And the fact that we've got to make good decisions is painfully obvious. The penalties of bad decisions are all around us. It's just literally how and on what basis do we make those decisions? So the theme for today is around pragmatism. It's looking at the best technologies for research and sensing that are out there, and what can that tell us around what is solid and sticking and what has turned fluid and is no longer reliable and is moving and sometimes still accelerating. So it's thinking about the technologies involved with that, but it's also thinking, what can we base our decisions on? So I'm going to be talking big picture. I'm looking at the wider pressures and particularly the decisions that companies have made and the decisions that led to a better outcome and the decisions that have led to a catastrophe. And landing that back, particularly inside of the US and the homewares market, Catalina is going to be talking around the consumer elements that have stuck with us through the pandemic and are looking to be affecting decision making ongoing. In terms of reactions to instability, we have, since the 2020s, effectively a Darwinian crucible. We've been subjected to a degree of change, and keeping up with that change is something that means we've got to run incredibly hard, we've got to change direction incredibly often, and some people have not made it along the journey. So if we think about the sorts of lessons that we've learned through this period, there are two I'm going to focus on inside of my session today. The first one is around risk and managing risk, predicting risk. So if we think about the first of the penalties inside of 2020, even this forecast was wrong. We've had even worse things since. So the entire structure around decision making is based on causality. the idea that we can look a little bit back to predict forward and trend. And even that's been shaken. And we've had all manner of things around both supply and demand where they've all shown themselves to be increasingly fragile. So what we're looking at is effectively a challenge to just in time. And that got shaken in 2020. We had the lockdowns, we had the instability from that, but the shaking is continuing and just getting worse. So what's interesting inside of this is it began around the macro level, and we can see that the very first reaction to what was going on was pessimism, over-pessimism. And it took until very late in the year before we started to actually see that come back. And we had categories, including in housewares, which were initially predicted to go back 10, 15%, that ended up 5 points up in the year. This has stayed with us, and we've actually kept this degree of pessimism inside of the structures, inside of how we view the future. If we then think, what was the next thing? Well, we got better at actually predicting sizes and changes, but then inflation came along, and part of the inflation issue was caused by the scarcity, which was partly caused by the pessimism. So the whole thing starts to spiral, and then what's the next shock? Well, then we ended up with the war, we had the shipping issue, we had Suez Canal, et cetera, it just keeps going. And this is the thing, we're now conditioned for the next shock. We're all just waiting for the next shoe to drop. Is it the recession? Is it the collapse of the housing market? Is it, if there is no big shock, we're almost going to be disappointed because we've been conditioned to expect these things on a near 6 month cycle now. So inside of particularly the cookware area and the cooking trend. So we see on the macro side that pessimism, but the actual predictions for cookware got quite harsh during 2020, and what we've ended up with is going into 2023, cookware and stovetop cookware is 18 points up versus the pre-pandemic period, utensils 11 points up versus pre-pandemic. So we see this inside of this particular category, and we can see what happened in terms of the supply and the availability of stock. So we had the SKU availability crash, and part of it was to do with instability on the supply side. Part of it is instability on demand and the fact that demand suddenly spikes and we didn't see it coming, and then we didn't see the next spike coming and then the next one. And suddenly healthy eating is this huge thing globally, which has gone up 5, 6 in some parts of the world, 12 points, and is driving incredible levels of change on, and suddenly there's a steel shortage and suddenly there's an aluminium and so blah, blah, blah. And on we've gone living through this. You can see it inside of the availability of SKUs. All it takes is one critical part for one critical SKU and it's dead, and suddenly you're facing the scramble to fix this. And we've faced that scramble so many times. So where are we right now? About 26% of housewares, homewares companies think that their supply side is fixed. Most of those are in Asia. Then we turn to the guys who think that their plan is going to solve their problems this year. And that's about 36% for homewares. It's closer to 40% in the furniture space. A little bit more advanced. This is where effectively they've got plans. They know when it's going to go live. They know the cost and the budget and everything attached to it. It's done. And it's just a question of when does it land. But you'll notice with the homewares, it's far more back-end loaded versus the furniture guys. There are solutions, but they took a bit longer to put in place. And then we look at the long term and where we still see major problems. A lot of this is in the US and in particularly Eastern Europe, where perhaps it's still getting worse. Perhaps the plan that was going to come into place in 2023 has just been blown by a new thing which has gone wrong. And this is effectively why people are still scrambling, thinking, is there ever going to be a solution to this? How do we get reliability? And that's the magic word. Reliability is what people are seeking, and there's lots of ways they're going about seeking that. So if we look at the conversation and how people are fixing it, so we can see an enormous part of the conversation. This is one of the new technologies for research. So we're looking at the size of the conversation across all communications that that companies have got out there. It's annual reports, it's quarterly reports, it's sustainability reports, it's the transcripts from CEOs talking to investors. It's everything that's physically out there, analyzed by the AIs for all of the connotations around the language used. So we can see the biggest conversation's been around factory capacity and particularly right-sizing. And A big chunk of that's actually neutral. It's to do with reviews. It's to do with people looking, are we actually in the right locations? Do we have the right capacity? Are we able to fulfill demand? But then we do have a part of that conversation which is already talking about reducing capacity and cutting and moving away from certain areas. There is a very small conversation happening around increasing capacity that's generally based on safety stock, and it's to do with the exposure to Russia, exposure to China, and some of the worries that are inside of that space. If we think about the inflationary versus deflationary, that's a less common topic, but more companies are talking about it, but less often, and it's reducing as we go forward as well. It's quite a strong neutral conversation, but there is actually still some negativity with costs rising, but also we're starting to see some conversation happening around deflation, but look at the size of that around people talking about putting prices back down again. It started in some areas. US is probably one of the healthiest for this, but that's far away from what Europe are doing. And then we've got some of these other conversations going on. They used to be a lot bigger, but effectively, if we look at the efficiencies and cost pressure conversation, that would have been totally dominant if we looked at this picture a couple of years ago. So what is actually the plan? How are people gaining security, and what does reliability look like? Well, one of the biggest things that we can see coming through is the efforts that are going into local supply. In some cases, this is about setting targets for local supply and increasing local supply, but actually, in the case of the housewares industry, we're from our industry surveys, we know that about 10% of companies have already cut global supply lines and are moving towards local supply relationships. This is one of the ways that people are achieving reliability. The reshoring and nearshoring topic have been ramping up, but just to put some context on that, that's mapping the same data against the shipping index, just to make the point that some of the urgency seems to be going out of that. And we've heard a number of projects where people had begun nearshoring activity, bringing production over to Mexico from China, and they've actually put that back on hold, and they're back into the review phase rather than activating it because shipping's no longer as big a deal. So how are companies reacting, and how are they seeking reliability? One of the observations I would make, and this is not limited to home and garden, I'm hearing the same things across many, many industries, just in time has failed. It's left us incredibly vulnerable to all of these things that have gone wrong, and if we hold to it, it will continue to leave us vulnerable. So the interim that we're actually heading into, it's termed just in case. It's around contingency. It's the mindset change of what else is going to go wrong and are we ready for it? It's particularly around the idea of having backup plans, modular production. Don't allow a SKU to die because effectively one thing goes wrong and that's it. It was dependent, and now we have more suppliers capable of providing that, more reactions possible in the bag. So one of the things I'm observing in the field work, we just finished our latest annual field work in February, so this is a global observation. We're not having conversations to anything like the same degree around a forecast for 2023. There isn't one forecast for 2023. There are contingent multiple forecasts for 2023. And yes, there's a core plan. There's an idea as to what this year's going to look like. But we've also got lots of movement heading into an optimistic perspective. If there are stimulus packages, if deflation starts to affect affordability, this is what we think happens inside of the market and the structure of the market. The other side of the coin, no stimulus packages, and we're heading into recession. Some people are forecasting a heavy recession, dependent on what happens to housing. We can see some of the data happening in that already. So there are multiple plans, and then of course there's the black swan. And because of how many shocks we've gone through, there are more and more people starting to enact black swan scenarios. Looking at how that's working, it's not about having just a plan. There's got to be the pre-work that's attached to it. So it's about more due diligence. More suppliers have been brought online and are ready to go in the event that something goes wrong. It's about having this idea of plan C as something that's a lot more fleshed out, it's real. You can just flip to plan C at the drop of a hat, and it's around the fact that we're changing direction far more often than we used to. The other thing that we're observing in projects that we're being asked to do on the consultancy side, and also what we're asked around our data sets, is insight is all very well. It's what we've based most of our R&D functions, marketing communications functions on, but anyone who knows how to drive knows that using the rear view mirror or any of the mirrors that point backwards to actually pick your path has got a few problems with it. So all of the problems we've had have come from the front, and they've come without a hell of a lot of historical warning. So it's back into the fact that the most appealing change of mindset that we're seeing come through is this pivot from insight to foresight, and all of the modeling, all of the efforts going into trying to see what the next 3, 6, 9, 12 months looks like, so that if there is one of these shocks coming, we'll hear about it inside our own systems rather than on CNN or some other form of communication. The other thing that we've seen coming through is the realization that not having geopolitics is a fairly serious chunk of the insight function has proven to be a mistake. And there are a number of big picture stories. We could talk about war, we could talk about the implications and the relationship of war and business. We could look at COVID and all of the lockdown reactions. That's the big stuff. We've even got lots of little stuff that's also still operating inside of this space. So Mexico, we've got scarcity issues in Mexico and lots of investment into new production in Mexico, but a lot of that is actually Chinese companies investing in Mexico in order to bypass the tariffs and the trade policies of the US. If we then think about Poland, Poland has its forecast completely dependent upon whether or not politicians will act in self-preservation and provide stimulus packages in the next election cycle coming in September. So people who are thinking optimistically about Poland are thinking that the politicians will use stimulus and to hell with inflation. And the ones that are pessimistic are thinking the politicians will be altruistic and do what's in the best interests of the country. If we then think about Turkey, Turkey's appeared on the risk matrix as a low-cost manufacturing base because ideologically it had no solutions to inflation. And so there were a barrier to fiscal policies and governments, what they were willing to do, what they were able to do, actually defined whether this was a risk country. And then, of course, we've got the big one, which is actually defining a lot of the anxiety around Chinese production and around exposure to China with the recent education we've received as to what can happen when a country like Russia has behaved as it has in the community reaction to that. So this is actually one of the things that's defining many of those local supply, reshoring, nearshoring topics. And I just want to call out for one of the comments from the head of IKEA recently. This is one that I also find resonates with me quite a bit, is we used to celebrate and get excited about being accurate on forecasting, at 0 point something inside of that. We're way past that point. The mechanisms now are around how to get to some degree of accuracy so that our systems don't break. And just one of the observations we've found within this most recent cycle is climate change is obviously another shock that's coming, and it's not a future shock anymore. One of the things that we've picked up on is a lot of companies have started to change their sourcing ready for this already, and it's things like pine, wood, cotton are no longer growing where they used to grow, and their yields are dropping because the temperature and the humidity is not right for them anymore. We're seeing insect species change at a very rapid speed. So it's the pest side of it, but it's also then the reactions. We're seeing things like plant species that used to be able to survive in a location that don't anymore. We're also seeing things like extreme weather, and particularly if there's product aimed for the outdoors, anything made of clay has done really badly over the last summer with all of the baking effect going on, then subjected to extreme weather. The level of breakage has been incredible, and it's caused flipovers into plastic. It's caused all manner of other things going on. This is now, it's not futurology anymore. The second lesson that we're looking at is around managing risks and managing profit. So if we think about pricing, it's been stable. It's been this thing that we could teach. It was based upon cause and effect. There were elements here that we could mentor people on and bring them on. But if we then think about what it's like now, it's a hell of a lot more now like juggling ducks, while unicycling over a gorge with a fraying rope, and it's a unicycle, so how can all these backseat drivers still sit on here and tell us what to do? So I don't want to be another backseat driver, but I will share the one lesson we pick out from the last 18 months or so of what not to do. This was the picture, we're all familiar with that picture in terms of the scariness of commodities and how rapidly it went. We can see wood as probably the early warning sign. Wood was the one that showed us where this is heading first with its waves and spikes. But it's just worth noting many, many, many companies beyond homewares, beyond home and garden, chose not to pass cost forward at a timely rate. And yes, there's lots of reasons for it, and I'll touch on those, but effectively, this was the mistake, this was the error. If we look at what's happening, the extreme example I've got is in the tools side for home improvement. We've got a gap that means if all of the costs had actually been passed on, inflation would have been 19%. It was actually 6%. And so that's the absorption level across the chain as to what really got passed forward. And what's the actual side effect of that? That's a 13-point gap. And actually, a lot of it was to do with FOMO, a fear of missing out. The ones that suffered from this the most were the ones that had the best results, the best booming markets, the best sales growth, and it left them vulnerable to actually not passing costs forward. And this is actually one of the big fundamentals for business models. If you can't pass cost forward into the market, it's one of the things McKinsey, one of the things Deloitte are first looking for in terms of the health of your business. And we can see some of the side effects. So this is one of the most advanced tools makers in the world, and they're close to 20% profitability less than a year and a half ago, and they're currently scraping towards negative profit. And it's collapsed inside of this time frame because they managed to achieve a 7% price increase. That was slightly better than the average for their sector. They faced 16% headwinds. That was slightly better than their sector. They managed to do some cost-saving programs over and above, local supply over and above their sector. So this is the healthy version of this story for that particular sector. And this is the problem. If we delay the price rises because we're waiting for the market to calm down and we don't push prices forward, even inside of a boom, even inside we could lose market share, even it could put factory capacity at risk, it could actually do many, many things, not doing it leads to this. The problem is around scarcity and the negotiation. When you're in a booming market, the scarcity is stock, and the actual benefit is on the supplier. When you're in a declining market, scarcity is on factory orders. Brinkmanship serves the retailer, and that's actually been one of the biggest barriers for the last 9+ months for passing costs forward. And that then raises the question, does everyone still have the ability to seek win-win, or are we actually now into a phase, and this is one of the big things we're starting to observe, some players who have been partners for 15, 20 years, they need win-lose. If they don't get win-lose, they might not be viable anymore. So this is breaking everything from trust through trains, etc. And if we then think about where that's heading to, we're now into a deflationary environment, but there are guys out there with 6, 9, 12 months of stock in the pipeline that are locked into those higher prices, and it's more attractive to bring new stock in and sell the new stock at the lower pricing for promo purposes than it is to deal with that warehouse. So the let's say that the unicycle on the gorge, the decision making for pricing is not getting any easier. If we then think about the FOMO, it's not just about homewares, it's much bigger than that, and it's not just about market share. One of the other big conversations we can see looking at the AI side, size of conversation for industry is the grey block at the back, and how homewares indexes against that is actually the bars. And then we see the most recent 90 days, private label is actually one of the big motivations for why in cookware, and particularly homewares, that price rise and that passing cost forward was so shied away from in terms of encouraging private label to continue to be a big thing. And it's bigger than all of these industries. If you think the CEO of Coca-Cola is starting to actually get excited about this particular topic, it's across everywhere that boomed. Everywhere that had a good experience in 2020, 2021 of growth, of more consumer interest, more consumer spend, that was the weakness, that was the vulnerability. It made people more vulnerable to this. And what we can see in terms of reactions is the companies are starting to spend a lot more money on the tracking for live pricing and be ready for price movement far more. And we're seeing far more interest in what's possible with SKU tracking and online. So what are the biggest lessons that come out of it? Just in case has replaced just in time. It's got more contingencies about it and it's leading us into scenarios rather than single forecasts. Geopolitics is a fundamental part of the insight function, the foresight function, and it's part of the other investment that we're seeing in terms of upgrades inside of businesses, services that people are asking for. And climate change is already upon us. We've got to retain this FOMO lesson, and it's an institutional one. 2020 taught us all about forecasting and the problems with forecasting. 2022 has taught us all about margin management, and we've got to remember what the lesson was from this. And the other point to just end on is that this AI tools and AI price tracking is ramping up within the research side, and it's probably the biggest, most interesting type of project that we're seeing in numbers and scale and across this sector particularly. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll pass you over to my colleague Catalina to land this inside of the US.
Thank you so much, Nick. We will now go into some trends and topics that are important to US consumers within the homewares industry. So overall, the industry had a challenging year in 2022. There was some growth, but it was mainly due to price increases and not really volume. And in the forecast period, we took inflation, so you can see real demand. And we will see that 2023 will be a little bit challenging, but overall the demand will normalize over the forecast period as consumers are cooking more and going back to the kitchen. Now, looking at each category for homewares, we see that 2022 saw important growth in categories like food storage. This was because consumers were going back to work. Because of everything being so expensive, they were bringing food to work. Additionally, because of consumers' interest in sustainability, they were replacing their plastic containers for glass. And also, water bottles are within this category, and that category also was pushed by that. Stovetop cookware and ovenware saw some growth, but as we said earlier, it was because of price increases. And dining, which is plates, beverageware, etc., it didn't do as well because it wasn't an essential when consumers didn't have as much disposable income. Now, while inflation is expected to decrease, Euromonitor is still forecasting relatively high inflation for 2023. And this is important because consumers, especially Gen Zs and millennials, they've never experienced inflation this high in their lifetime. So it's something that's completely new to them. And for Gen X, the last time they experienced a situation like this was when they were children and had no purchasing power. So if we look at a consumer's planned spending for 2023, we see that consumers are planning on spending more on essentials. So for example, saving money, it's top of the list, visiting discount stores, spending on groceries, which really benefits our industry, and purchasing secondhand items, which is a huge trend across industries. And the things where consumers are trying to decrease their spending are things that are non-essential. So for example, visiting restaurants, which again benefits our industry, and overall spending. Now, also according to our consumer lifestyle survey, we see that cooking or baking almost every day is increasing in the US. And we see an important increase for Gen Zs. And this is really important because Gen Zs, they're in the cusp of their financial independence, and most of their formative years, or a couple of their formative years, were spent during the pandemic. They're digital natives, so they will change the industry as they join. They are changing every industry that they join. However, we do see that consumers, and especially Gen Zs, are claiming that they don't have enough time to cook. So this is a big issue, and 20% of US consumers are claiming that they would rather do things other than cooking. So this opens up the opportunity for products that offer time saving, but also for adding time saving claims to existing products. Now, if we look at private label versus well-known brands, we see that the interest or the attachment to brands is shrinking, while the interest for private label or low-cost products is expanding. This can be explained because of the situation we're in, less disposable income, inflation, etc. But also, the US is a country that has really developed and invested in private labels. Private labels are have great design, good quality, and are cheap. So we see an example of this here. Early last year, Crate & Barrel launched a cookware brand as a private label brand, The Kitchen by Crate. Now, looking at sustainability, we see that consumers more than ever are, they understand the power of their purchases, and they're looking at companies in a lot of detail. So on one hand, consumers are looking to buy sustainably produced items, but they're also looking for purpose-driven companies. And they know that if a company is not aligned with their beliefs, they will not hesitate to boycott them. We have a company here at the Homeware Show, Fable. They're a homeware company, and they're a certified B Corporation, for example. And even though that's not the first thing that consumers are looking for when they look at their products, seeing that Fable is a certified B Corporation helps them make that final decision of making that purchase. Now, we also see that in the US, 60% of consumers feel that they can make a difference in the world through their actions. And almost 55% of them really research the products that they buy. And this is important because for generations like Gen Zs, they are not, they're immune to traditional marketing and advertising. Consumers are looking for a real connection and authenticity from the brands that they support. Now, continuing on sustainability, we have seen great efforts from some brands. We see here an example from Calphalon and Rubbermaid. They partner with TerraCycle to, you can ship back your products to TerraCycle and they will recycle them. And they accept products from every brand. However, we see that the industry is lacking on options for sustainability. I mean, aluminum is one of the most recyclable materials in the world. However, most of the cookware items end up in a landfill. So consumers are looking for companies that go in the sustainability journey with them and give them real options, time-saving options, and they will reward those companies. Now, if we look at also a sustainability-related trend, secondhand shopping, we see that it's really growing in the US across industries. And it's also now growing within homewares. We see that, and it's across generations. We see on one hand, in person, you have thrift stores, antique stores, but then you have Facebook Marketplace online. There is this company, Mindful Market Company, where you can buy homewares through the internet, which is a great option for consumers, and they're looking for that. We see even, and there's options for companies to add to the secondhand world. We see Patagonia, for example, they have an official secondhand store. So there is no reason why cookware, homeware companies wouldn't be able to join this trend. Now, if we look at materials for a second, and this is an analysis of SKUs across 28 markets, we see that nonstick is growing, and it's especially growing in North America. North American consumers are really interested in healthy eating, and nonstick is a great way for them to do this healthy eating. Also, something just to keep an eye on is that a glass stovetop cookware is growing at a small level, but it's something to keep an eye on once the gas prices decrease. And we see that consumers strongly believe that they should improve their eating habits. And this is especially true for millennials in the US. We saw that millennials found themselves being very sedentary for 2 years, and then they realized that their bodies weren't bouncing back as quickly as they did before. So now we have a huge interest that for millennials to improve their eating habits. This didn't happen to other generations like Gen Zs because they're so young that their bodies bounce back so quickly. And it didn't happen to Gen X or boomers because they already went through that. And this explains the success of healthy eating cooking items like ceramic cookware or air fryers, for example. And if we look at online shopping, we see that US consumers are mostly buying online weekly. And this is especially true for millennials. They really like the convenience of online shopping, and the options that they can find online are more suited for their needs and their aesthetic. And it is important to note that in the US, e-commerce in 2022 had the slowest growth rate since 2013, but it still grew even after crazy growth in 2020 and 2021. And now if we look at specifically homewares in the US, we see that most of the products are still being purchased in person, around 72%, but e-commerce, which for Euromonitor also includes click and collect, it has now a 28% of purchases. This is really important. The category grew 10 points since the pandemic and is sticking. The category continues to grow. Now, looking at direct-to-consumer brands, we see that direct-to-consumer brands continue to penetrate. Consumers want personalized shopping experiences online. And especially, again, millennials, who are the ones that are shopping online more, they want this. And we see that direct-to-consumer brands get to react quicker to change. If a consumer changes, it's easier for a smaller brand to react. They have less stock, so they can be more aligned with consumers' needs. Now, direct-to-consumer brands have already and are still penetrating this space, but there is a need to build on a service model. And the manifestation of this is subscription services. We have seen subscription services across industries, and we are starting to see it in homewares. We have examples here of Kitchy Gadgets and Taste of Home Box that offer consumers seasonal subscription boxes with homeware items. And even though this is still not super popular in the industry, it is something to keep an eye on because it has worked in other industries. And if we look at consumers that currently use subscription services in the US, we see that it is increasing across generations. And even though this is not talking about homewares specifically, once a consumer is familiarized and likes a business model, it's easier to switch it and go to that model in a different industry. And now continuing on the online trends, we see that consumers are spending more and more time in social media. Consumers that have TikTok and Instagram go to those apps multiple times a day. So the amount of time that consumers spend online is getting more and more significant. And we have seen that specifically for our industry, the influence of social media has become really important. We see Hydro Flask, that was a product that had a big social media push before the pandemic, and we saw last year the Stanley tumblers became insanely popular. And this was a product that Stanley had discontinued, but an Instagram account started really pushing and asked Stanley to bring it back with the promise that their followers would buy it. And this grew beyond that Instagram account. The product was released and it has sold out several times. And even I was checking eBay, and you can buy a Stanley tumbler. They usually retail for around $40. You can buy it for $140 for the colors that are sold out. Even I saw a listing of $900 for a Stanley tumbler. However, even though consumers are spending more time in social media, there is a trend for de-influencing and controlling the scroll. And this is at a time where consumers are really not having as much disposable income, prices are through the roof. So there is a need for controlling the time you spend in social media, and the hashtag de-influencing, when we built this deck, had around 50 million views, and I checked this morning, and the hashtag de-influencing had 300 million views on TikTok. So it's a trend that's really exploding, and consumers are looking for minimize the effect of social media in their lives, and they're looking for companies to provide them filter and sharp content. Consumers do not want to be bombarded by notifications or content just because. They want intentional content. Additionally, they reward when companies give them time-saving content, and they're looking to build loyalty. Now, if we look at, and this is similar to what Nick showed earlier, if you look at the gray is all industries, and orange and blue are the homeware industries. If you look at the most important topics for homewares, you see that there is a bigger interest within homewares for understanding the consumer, secondhand shopping, and circular economy than in all the other industries. And this has really increased in the last 90 days. So the industry is aware of these trends. It's just now, when are they going to make those decisions and those changes to align with their consumers? And now to conclude, first, it's important to appeal to healthy eating. Consumers want to be healthier, want to use less oil in their preparations, and nonstick is very important for them. Additionally, we need digital strategies. Consumers, even though e-commerce is growing and they're looking for direct-to-consumer brands and tailored experiences, they also want better experiences online. Additionally, we have the rise of secondhand shopping, which is coming to the industry very quickly. And consumers are looking at sustainability, but beyond recycling. They're looking for purpose. They're looking at the companies. They're checking their policies. How are they behaving with even social issues? And they're not afraid to boycott them if necessary. And that's all we have prepared for you. If you want to download the presentation, please take a picture of the QR code and feel free to contact Nick or myself. Our emails are there, and let's connect on LinkedIn. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you both. I was wondering if there were any questions. Okay, well, I've got one. When we're looking at the world today, a lot of times we don't want to look. Things, and it's not necessarily it's dread, but it's the complications that have occurred. Mm-hmm. And as you say, shocks have put people in a feeling of pessimism. But they also have a certain resignation. Mm-hmm. A lot of people feel as if this is going to be a tale of 2 years. It's 2023 is going to be a tough first half and a much better second half. There seems to be some indications in your presentation that that could be true. There are other indications that maybe it's not going to be true. I mean, how do you look at the year ahead mm-hmm. in terms of will there be more traction in the economy? Will it be a better economy, an improved economy? And will consumers respond to that? Because as you see, there's some conflict between what consumers think and what the actualities are. How do you feel that's going to evolve?
I think there are three variables in play. So one of the factors is around deflation. So we've seen shipping hit a 700 index for global influence and the cost versus pandemic to where it reached at the height of the trauma, the cost of a container, and it's now back to a bit more than pre-pandemic, but it's back into a reasonable level. We're also seeing steel get back under control. We're seeing all of the main commodities are now turning into deflationary pressures. The counteraction to that is how much of a pipeline of very high cost stock is still sat inside of the pipeline from the Far East, from other low cost manufacturing bases, how far and how big is the distance for the supply. So some brands, particularly the largest brands, will have a bigger pipeline to cope with before they can pass those savings onto the consumer. And the magic word is affordability. Like what is affordability inside of an environment like this? We've got pressures coming from below and from above. It's finding that middle point. And the third factor that's going on inside of this is around the stimulus packages and the temptation towards further stimulus packages. We've got inflation, we've got the parliamentary and all of the other election cycles. I think that one is probably the most critical. Is a country going through an election? Does it actually need to get people elected inside of this year's time period? That seems to be one of the biggest things that's defining optimism to pessimism when you compare across different markets. I think deflation is possibly one of the things that will create the saving grace. It's the thing that might make the second half a lot more fun than any of the decisions that we've faced. We now have the difficult price decision of when to put prices down and how much of the old margin that we lost historically could we recover before we put the prices down. But there'll be that competition around when to go, who goes first, the degrees of, that there'll be pressure, but this is the other side of the coin to the pressure that we faced on the way up. So I think affordability is the magic one. My view around second half is it almost 50-50 coin toss at this moment in time around positivity to negativity. There's as much pressure causing one as the other.
Thanks. I actually have another question because, and it's not necessarily a different question, but it's approached from the opposite angle. I'm working a theory, or I believe, from information that I've seen, that people are going to stay home this summer much more so than they might have wanted. They may have wanted to travel, but they're not ready to spend that discretionary income. Mm-hmm. They've invested in their homes, they've invested in their outdoor spaces, and I feel as if, from the things that I've read, outdoor living, indoor-outdoor living, family parties, cocktail nights, all of these things are going to be a very big thing this summer and could potentially kick off another spurt of buying for the home as a center of entertainment. Do you think, of course we can't know, but do you think that's a viable possibility?
I think it's one of those six of one, half dozen of another. If we don't get the upside for the economy, whereby people aren't as worried about spending money, and therefore they cut back, so they actually don't want to spend on the holiday, they don't want to spend on the, so they're actually then staying home, that's a situation that generally benefits all of the in-home spend categories. So there's less spend on all of the luxuries. You could see it in Catalina's charts earlier. Where are people looking to make their savings? It's on all of the out-of-home luxuries. It's holidays and it's eating out, etc. That then means more money goes into the home because we're home more often, blah, blah. So yes, you're right. That on that side of it, we will get an upside. If the actual economy does boom and does end up coming back again and we end up with stimulus packages, we end up with an avoidance of recession, this becomes a moot question anyway, because then it's around just general normal income patterns, the use of disposable income. So it's not a doom scenario for cookware. You could see we're actually forecasting some growth inside of 2023. I would say this is one of the healthiest categories I have sight of when I compare across all of my scope, and also the CAP guys for consumer appliances, home care, that the supply situation on the homewares category is one of the healthiest. The demand situation on homewares is one of the healthiest we get to see, because all of it balances out in this category.
That's great. And any other questions? Well, I want to thank you.
Thanks very much
for the presentation, and I want to thank the people for attending. It's appreciated.